In the mid-50s, two men knocked over a kerosene stove during a fight at a concert. After fleeing the blaze, the guitar player realized he left his beloved Gibson inside. B.B. King then ran in and saved it. He later learned that the fight was over a woman named Lucille, and ever since, his guitars have borne that name. You can find Lucille at the Hard Rock in Hollywood, Florida. Thousands of other priceless pieces of rock history can be found at Hard Rock cafes, casinos, and hotels around the world. To learn more, visit hardrock.com.
Little Steven's Underground Garage's Coolest Conversations, presented by Hard Rock Cafe, hosted by the Mighty Manfred.
This is the Mighty Manfred and his Coolest Conversations podcast time, presented by Hard Rock in Little Steven's Underground Garage. Thanks for listening, and please remember to follow and subscribe, rate, and review. Joining me today is bassist Cat Popper, who's performed and or recorded with the likes of Jack White, Ryan Adams, Tommy Stinson, Nora Jones, Brian Fallon, Willie Nelson, and Jesse Malin, among others. She also pursues a solo career, and her debut single, Maybe It's All Right, is available on Jesse Malin's label Velvet Elk Records. And she also plays on Jesse's newest single for Wicked Cool Records, The Way We Used to Roll, a recent coolest song in the world. Let's hear some of that now, followed by my chat with Kat on our Coolest Conversations podcast, presented by Hard Rock in Little Steven's Underground Garage.
It's begin at the end, I'm in trouble again. You can ignore it all till you lose all your friends. Man of the future with all of the rage till the money ran out. Had to do what they say.
Manfred here, and it's time for your Coolest Conversations. Joining me today is Cat Popper, who we've heard here in the Underground Garage mainly as the bass player on Jesse Malin's recordings, but she's also played with the likes of Jack White, Brian Fallon, Ryan Adams, Nora Jones, Willie Nelson, Tommy Stinson, and many other greats. And recently, she's done some of her own songwriting. How are you, Cat?
Hey, I am just still sort of waking up, but I can imagine that you are especially still just waking up, considering it's very early there.
Absolutely. let's see now, were you in New York City a year ago this time when things got to be their most crazy and ultimately very tragic?
I was, yes.
And how did you cope with all that?
I panicked. I was like a chicken with my head cut off. I was playing in a Broadway show at the time. I had just signed on to play in a Broadway show, and a couple of people on the show got really sick. I have I'm a type 1 diabetic and an asthmatic, so I was pretty freaked out to say the least. Yeah, it was I think this city is just starting to heal, to be honest. Like the rest of the world, you know. But this is where I am, and I know what's going on here. So that's why I say that about New York.
Wow. And so some of your coworkers in the Broadway production that you said they had gotten ill, did they recover okay?
They did. One was hospitalized, and one said that his teeth chattered so hard that they shattered. So thank God that they were okay. Thank God.
Wow. Now, have you had the opportunity, the chance yet to get vaccinated?
I did. I was in the last group because of my, illnesses, and yeah. I had my second vax about 2 weeks ago.
Well, congratulations.
Thank you.
Yeah, I'm waiting to get jabbed myself. I haven't had that good fortune yet.
I tried not to be frustrated at the rollout, and I had friends who had messaged me that they lied to get in, to get vaccinated. And it was hard for me to hear that because I know that there was a lot of people who couldn't get it, who needed it. Here we are.
We'll get through it. I read online that you are from Charlotte, North Carolina. And so I was going to ask you how old you were when you first got into the Milestone Club. But then I saw that you had, you had attended the North Carolina School of Arts. And I thought that was in Winston-Salem. So what's the story? Where exactly did you grow up?
Well, I grew up in Charlotte, and I went to the Milestone Club probably for the first time when I was like 15 or 16. I'm sure somebody else was most likely driving. Yeah. And 4808 was another club, a great club there. Gwar played and got the whole place. I think the cops came and arrested them or something. It was like, it was an interesting time for music. It was very subversive to have these punk clubs there. But I went away to North Carolina School of the Arts in Winston for high school in like 11th grade. My parents said, I was sitting around the mall shooting off fireworks with kids with mohawks and like nose chains. And so they decided to send me away to better myself.
Did you better yourself?
Maybe. I guess it remains to be seen.
Mm-hmm. Well, you started playing bass when you were 9. Is that right?
I started playing upright bass at 9. Yes.
And why did you decide to play an upright bass?
Well, the year before that, I started with violin in 5th grade, and I hated it. It was so loud. It was right next to my face. And I think I saw Sting. I was obsessed with the Police, and I saw Sting playing an upright bass. And I thought, well, why am I doing this if I could be doing that? So I switched.
So your family is a musical sort of background in your family?
No. My father's from Romania, and his family they immigrated to New York in the late 30s. Uh-huh. And they spent a lot of time going to the opera. They had box seats at the Met with Peter Sellers' parents, which I always thought was interesting. And my Southern people used to sit around on the porch and pick bluegrass, but nobody in my family has musical talent. So
as you were a child, they were still insistent, though, that you take an instrument, and then you wound up choosing switching to the bass?
No, they weren't insistent. I was just always at the piano, and I started taking piano lessons when I was really young. And what wasn't the biggest fan of piano lessons, so it was my idea to take up the violin in 5th grade because all the popular kids did it.
Now, those kids didn't have any nose chains at the time, though.
No, those kids had no nose chains.
No. So you start these lessons and you're playing stand-up bass, and then you get sent to the School of the Arts. When did you realize that you could make a living playing the bass?
Well, that never occurred to me that it was going to happen. Mm-hmm. But at School of the Arts, I was studying classical music, and I realized I hated everything about the idea of learning excerpts in a room for 8 hours a day just to get into an orchestra. It just wasn't my bag.
Yeah.
I discovered jazz, and I came to New York City and studied jazz upright bass at Manhattan School of Music. And I would temp down at the World Trade Center from 7 to 7 every day, bring my upright bass there and go play gigs a few nights a week. And I don't think it occurred to me that I was going to make a living. It really took me by surprise. I think it wasn't until my late 20s I went on my first tour. And even then I wasn't sure that it would happen. So it took me by surprise.
So how did you make this transition from starting to play with jazz and into working with rock, pop, contemporary musics?
Well, I was always kind of an idiom nerd when I was a kid. You probably remember when you had to go to a bunch of different like record stores to get different kinds of records. I don't know where you grew up, but like you couldn't just get them all in one place, So if I wanted to get Irish like traditional music, I had to go to that store. And there was one, like the Record Exchange did have a pretty decent selection, but if I wanted jazz, like I had to go to a jazz record store. And I spent a lot of time doing that. So when I came to New York and studied jazz, I went to the Limelight and, saw a few punk bands. And I used to go sit on the Irish traditional sessions and the bluegrass traditional sessions in another place. I don't know if you can hear that music, but I actually went to the Latin Quarter and took salsa lessons so I could play merengue, salsa, I just loved all. So it wasn't really that much of a stretch for me. It was the biggest problem was going from upright bass to electric bass, because it was really physically uncomfortable for me at first. So I didn't really start playing electric bass until I would say like I was 31, maybe 32.
And you started going out on the road and playing with bands. And so does that coincide to about the time you're picking up the electric bass?
Maybe right after. I said, I'm going to commit to learning this electric bass thing. And I listened to a few Beatles records and I was like, wow, I get the Beatles now. Like I just could never access 70s rock before. And then once I was like playing along, I started to get it. And I think it just sort of coincided. Then I started to get called for gigs that were more rock oriented, but it wasn't like I was some slumming, snooty jazz classical musician. Like I was all in, you know?
And so you spent a lot of time touring on the road with a lot of different artists. And there's a pretty big irony here that last year your plan was to take a break from the road. And you mentioned this, the Broadway show, and then everything gets shut down. So what was the show that you were supposed to be playing in last year?
Well, in all fairness, 2 years before that, I was in a show called Head Over Heels. The Go-Go's musical. It wasn't about the Go-Go's, but it was the music of the Go-Go's. And I was still touring because on Broadway, you can sub out up to 50% of your shows once the show opens. So there's a lot of touring musicians who play on Broadway shows. But the Broadway show that I started last year is called Diana. It's about Princess Diana. And we had just gone into like day two of previews, but it's a fantastic, the music is fantastic, and it's such a love fest, that show. So they say we're going to open up in the fall, but you know, we're still here.
And so when the lockdown happened, were you guys, just furloughed? Like there was no income from that? There was just shut down, or is there some type of were able to be compensated in some way over the course of last year?
Well, that's one great thing about Broadway is the, you know, it's nice work if you can get it, and it's W-2 employment. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you could get health insurance and you can get unemployment. So I've been on unemployment this whole time.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, good. Now, I mentioned some of these amazing people you've worked with, and, I'll go over some of the names again. They're like Jack White and Brian Fallon and Nora Jones, who worked within Puss in Boots. There's Willie Nelson, Tommy Stinson. I was wondering if there were like any one of these people that you've worked with where if they were just to call you out of the blue and say, hey, I really need you, drop whatever you're doing. Can you come and record with me right now? Is there anybody that you would like, okay, I'll drop what I'm doing and to go work with that person again?
Well, as long as dropping what I'm doing doesn't mean screwing over whoever I'm working with at the time.
Right.
The first two times that Jack called, their management called me, they said, can you fly down tomorrow and play with the band? And both times I said, I'm sorry, I have a gig tomorrow, but if you give me a little more notice, I can do that. Cause I don't want to screw over my friends, you know? And I thought, well, there goes that, but you know what I mean? Like I just feel like it's important to keep my,
to honor your obligations. I mean, you don't want it.
Yeah.
You don't want to dishonor your obligations because you work with those people again and you want to be reliable so that you have a good working relationship going forward. And
And I know that, you know, smaller artists, it's a big deal for them to pay for rehearsals and then to play these small gigs. And I just felt like, I don't know. There's a line somebody told me, if it's important, it's not urgent. And if it's urgent, it's not important. And I thought, you know what? I can't do this. And both times I said no. And then they called me and they were like, look, can you just do the gig? So it worked out. But I mean, honestly, all of those people I would work with again. You know, touring has been really rough on my body over the years. Mm-hmm. I don't know how people do it. I'm 47. I don't know how people do it into their 50s and 60s and even above. So I don't know if I would go on like a long tour anymore, but, you know, I love all those. I feel rich as a Rockefeller, man. The people that I've worked with, got to spend time with and make music with.
Well, here's something I found sort of amusing. Let me ask you this. How did you find out where Bruce Springsteen is from?
I forgot that was in the press release.
Yeah.
When somebody asked me to write my bio for a press release, I didn't write anybody who I'd played with. I just wrote all the dumb stuff that I had done, and that was in there. But it wasn't my fault. We were at the Stone Pony many, many years ago, and a friend of mine, John Gracia, who worked with Bruce, said, "You should meet Bruce." And I said, I don't need to meet Bruce. I don't know what to say to Bruce. I'm good. And then next thing I know, he like turns me around by the shoulder and there's Bruce. And I thought, I have no idea what to say to Bruce. Like, what do you say? So I shook his hand and I said, "Hey man, such a pleasure, big fan." And I said, "I'm going to go and I'm going to let you talk to the other folks here." And he said, no, sit down. So me and Bruce are at a two top and I have no idea what to say. And he's just staring at me. And there's this line of angry looking, you know, New Jersey women who really want to have some FaceTime with Bruce. And I just said, "So where are you from?"
Did he tell you?
He did. I started laughing and he started laughing and he said that he was from right down the road, you know, that he was actually born here. And I was like, "Oh yeah, I'm pretty sure I knew that." And I said, "You know, I'm going to, you know, thank you so much for your time. This has been an honor," and blah, blah, blah. And he's like, no, stay. And I was like, "What?" So I said, "Well, I think maybe I get confused sometimes because sometimes you have a Southern accent." And I thought, I don't want to have this conversation. Why did I say that? Why do I want to say that? Like, it was so awkward because he was just staring at me with the biggest smile on his face. And I'm sure that it just got dumber from there. But every time I would ask a question, I would turn beet red and laugh, and he would laugh and answer earnestly. So,
well, you know, your conversation with him was probably way more interesting than he was going to have with anybody that was really intent on having FaceTime with him, you know?
Exactly what John said. John said he loves musicians. And he probably loved that you were having a good time and that you were just, you had no idea what you're doing. And it was, you know, because he would not let me get up.
You are in a recent issue of Bass Player Magazine. Congratulations about that. What does it feel like to be in Bass Player Magazine?
It was a little intimidating because that was one of those magazines where I was like, this is a magazine for people who know like what kind of strings are on their bass and, you know, what kind of amps they use and stuff. And like, I was shocked when I got when I did the interview. And then I thought, oh, you know what? It's totally okay to say, I don't know what kind of strings I use. I have an endorsement with Ashdown and I love Ashdown amplifiers, but in general, I can just talk about me and not talk about gear. And then they don't have to run the article if they don't want to. And it was fine. Nobody died and nothing broke.
Well, cool. Yeah. How and when did you and Jesse start working together?
Well, the first time I met Jesse was on a Ryan Adams tour. And Jesse was such a gentleman because we were so noisy on that bus. We smoked cigarettes on the bus, which is disgusting. We were up all night just listening to music and screaming. And poor Jesse, I don't know how I kept it together, but that's the first time we met. And then, you know, I'd see him around and we'd say hello, but he asked me to do one of the Strummerville benefits that he does for Music and Memory. Mm-hmm. And I thought, oh my God, I feel so cool that I would get to play songs. You know, I was like, these guys are too cool for me. So it went swimmingly. And then he just said, "Hey, would you be interested in playing with me?" And it was like, he was asking me out on a date. He was so tentative. And I said, yeah. And he was so stoked. And yeah, he's just been a fantastic friend ever since.
Well, let's talk some about this, the new single, the Jesse Malin single. It's called The Way We Used to Roll. It's our coolest song in the world this week. It's out now on Wicked Cool Records. And my notes say it was produced by Lucinda Williams and Tom Overby. I'm wondering, was this recorded during the sessions for the last album, Sunset Kids?
Okay, so not only is my memory not great, but Jesse spends a lot of time in the studio. So I'm going to go ahead and say yes. And especially if Lucinda and Tom were there, then it would probably have been at Studio B in Brooklyn. So I'm going to go ahead and say yes, but Don't hate me if I'm wrong.
No, absolutely not. Had you worked with Lucinda Williams before?
No, I had never worked with Lucinda.
What was it like to work with her in the studio?
She's just she's a joy. She's a light. She's so much fun. But, when you're in a studio and there's people producing, especially as a bass player, you kind of get left alone. It's my experience. Mm-hmm. So I didn't really interact with her much, during the takes. It was only because then I'd come in and it was there's notes for the drummer and there's notes for so-and-so. There's no, because they're the ones that are sort of, anyway. So I didn't really interact with her much during the actual recordings, but then, on the breaks when we would go out and have lunch together, she was just a hoot. She was a hoot.
Are you listening to the recording? I was wondering, is that you as part of the backing vocals?
I don't think so.
Do you the way we used to roll is a cool melancholy-ishness to about it. Does it resonate with you?
Yeah. I mean, it's a very, it has that sort of it's clashy, which I really like that Jesse borrows. He borrows from he's a musical encyclopedia. It's amazing. That guy just absorbs music across the genres, which is something that I like to do too. But he has this whole other encyclopedia that I don't have. So it's interesting talking about music with him, because I tell him about things too that he doesn't know, but it's more usually it's the converse, where he knows all this stuff. So I think it borrows from that tradition, but also the, I don't want to say dance hall, but the quarter notes, which is real clashy.
Yeah.
But it's also really I don't want to say Sam Cooke in a way, but sort of it borrows from a soul tradition that I can't put my finger on right now. I can't think of who I'm referencing.
It's interesting that you're bringing it up, because the B-side is Time Robber, and that definitely mentioned dance hall does have this ska-esque, almost reggae aspects to it, but also the melody that he's singing, it has a very Don Covey feel to it, like a Mercy Mercy kind of thing. And similarly, there's also that Sam Cooke presence that's in that. And I think that's another example of what you were talking about, the depth of his music knowledge and influences.
Yeah, it's just it's even if you don't really hear it, it's always sort of a, the high notes and the low notes of a perfume. It's the undertones of a perfume. It's always in there somewhere, which is funny, because, he's punk rock degen guy, but it's in there. And it's a really unusual recipe.
Well, today is Friday, and I know Jesse has a gig tonight at the Bowery Electric. So are you playing at the show?
I am not.
Okay. So it's two nights tonight and then two nights tomorrow night. Limited capacity, sold out. But the first show tonight is also a live streamed thing online at rollinglive.com. So you're not playing at this gig tonight, is that right?
I'm not playing tonight. Jesse and I play together on occasion, but when I started doing more of the Broadway stuff, he's I need somebody who I can have regularly. And he found James, who's just an unbelievable badass of a bass player. But Jesse and I, we talk a couple times a week, and he's, releasing a couple of my songs on his label, and I put down vocals remotely on stuff. So we still work together, but in the live capacity, not right now.
So have you done any live shows since last year?
No live shows. No, I haven't. We really keep it clean around here in terms of, until we were vaccinated, we didn't have a pod. We didn't see people. We picked up groceries. Being a diabetic, and my boyfriend has a comorbidity too. So I just got called for my first live gig this week, actually. So it was
Well, what is your first live gig upcoming?
Well, I didn't say yes.
Okay. You got called. Yeah. Well, it's good to know that the phone has started ringing again.
That's exactly what I said. Yeah.
Well, you mentioned working with Jesse and putting out songs on his label. So let's talk about that, because, in fact, in this what was it, the Bass Player magazine, you mentioned your the single Maybe It's All Right. That's your song. And the quote there in the magazine, you say, "Writing for me is like a portal that opens up mean voices telling me to play like someone else." Yeah. So these mean voices, how did you tame these voices and come up with Maybe It's All Right?
I think I just let them be there. You know, I don't think there's any overcoming. What I'm learning about myself is there is no overcoming things about my personality that stand in my way. It's just I make enough space around them to allow them to be there and then to allow other things to be there, you know?
Yeah. And that came out of this past year of lockdown and stuff, or how, what's the inspiration behind it?
Well, I set up my recording studio and stared at it, and I didn't pick up a guitar for months. I was burned out. And I just sort of set up my studio and started to play around on GarageBand. And I feel like it's such an honest expression because it just happened. And I would show up, and it took me about 6 weeks to write the song, which is a record for me. And I thought, well, I can't play the guitar because I'm not a very good guitar player. And I thought, okay. And I picked up the guitar, and it didn't make me think I could play the guitar. I just did it, you know? And yep. Then it just sort of kept happening, and it really took me by surprise. And Jesse is incredibly supportive of friends. He's like a huge supporter of the downtrodden. He is the first person to be super excited when somebody he cares about has something great happen. And he said to me, I just sent it to him. You know, he said, "I love this song. And what if we put it out on a label?" And I said, "Well, what do I have to do?" And he said, "Nothing." And I said, I assumed at first he was just trying to like maybe give me a lift or something. And I was like, You know, I love you and you don't have to do me any favors. He's like, "Would you please listen to me? I'd love this and I would love to put it out." And so I thought, okay. And then we made this, I had this concept for a video because I'm a huge history nerd. And so I researched archives of old photos and then went and drove around the city to see what those same buildings or statues or parks look like today. And if they looked anything similar, I got my friend, she's a videographer, Vivian Wong, to come, and we shot, if there's a juxtaposition of the old photos and then the present day photos. And it just showed how much of New York is actually still the same, even from hundreds of years ago. And it was such a fun project, and I just owe Jesse so much for encouraging me to do it, but I think it is a good song. And he's putting out my next single too. We just finished the video for it.
Oh, what's it called?
It's a Pear Ubu cover called Breath.
Uh-huh. And when can we expect it to be released?
Well, Jesse just texted me. He's like, "I just watched the video." So I don't know how like important people work. So apparently there's a certain amount of time after they get the video and things happen. So I would guess like a month. But again, I don't know how things work. I am just a bass player, man.
Well, we keep our eyes open for it. And Jesse's label, we should say, that's Velvet Elk Records, I'm thinking. Is that right?
Yes, thank you. Jesse Mallon and Don DeLego's record label, Velvet Elk Records.
Well, Kat, thanks so much for speaking with me today on our Coolest Conversations.
I love Jesse with all my heart, and I'm just so glad you guys are honoring him, and what a cool radio station too. So thank you for having me.
Well, thanks very much. We love Jesse a whole lot as well. And let's hear your tune right now. Okay. Here's your single on Velvet Elk Records. It's called Maybe It's All Right, from Kat Popper here in Little Stevens Underground Garage.
If I slow down and I lose, I guess I just get tired of waiting to feel alright. Maybe that's alright. I got a whiplash with a thousand ways to let you down.
Maybe It's All Right. That's the debut single from Cat Popper out on Velvet Elk Records. This is the Mighty Manfred, and thanks again to Cat for speaking with me today on our Coolest Conversations. Thanks to Olivia Callahan for producing our podcast. And join me next time when I'll chat with both Robin Zander and Rick Nielsen. Cheap Trick Week in the Underground Garage. Next time around, here in Little Steven's Underground Garage.
In the mid-50s, two men knocked over a kerosene stove during a fight at a concert. After fleeing the blaze, the guitar player realized he left his beloved Gibson inside. B.B. King then ran in and saved it. He later learned that the fight was over a woman named Lucille, and ever since, his guitars have borne that name. You can find Lucille at the Hard Rock in Hollywood, Florida. Thousands of other priceless pieces of rock history can be found at Hard Rock cafes, casinos, and hotels around the world. To learn more, visit hardrock.com.